Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. Jonglei state officials have arrested 15 people for issuing threats against Equatorians. And South Sudanese refugees use arts to promote peace and harmony in refugee camps. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Jonglei state officials say they have arrested 15 people suspected of writing a letter giving UN OCHA a 72-hour ultimatum to evacuate employees of UN agencies, international and local non-governmental organizations who hail from Equatoria. The Secretary of Information for the Boer Community Youth Association in Juba is assuring Equatorians and citizens of other states that nobody will harm them as they work in Boer. For VOA News, Michael Atit has more on that story from Juba.
Benjamin Lam is the Secretary General for Jonglei State Government. Lam confirms that at least 15 people have been arrested in connection with a letter addressed to UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, asking UN agencies, international and local NGOs to evacuate their employees who are from Equatoria or false and specified repercussions.
Some of them came confronting the government at our offices. They came to government offices and with a mob trying to argue the case. They will be tried, or they will be given a due process. The justice will take its course now. There are, should be more to be arrested.
Lam is assuring South Sudanese who hailed from Equatoria to remain calm as the Jonglei state authorities are apprehending the suspects behind the threats.
There is not an alarm in the town. Equatoria is still moving about. They normal duties. They are just working in the wherever they are. Government is in control. The people who have our law, the town, the government now have taken the stand still to get them and arrest them.
The leaders of Boer Community Youth Association in Juba have issued another statement seen by South Sudan in Focus. The two-page statement dated July 4th says, "Whereas youth leaders in Boer town have a right to express their concerns, it was wrong to issue threats and ultimatums." Jock Michael Ajak is the Secretary of Information for Boer Youth Group in Juba. Ajak says his colleagues in Boer should have addressed their letter to authorities concerned with employment and job opportunities in the state.
So if they are saying the local jobs should be at least given to the host communities, in this scenario, we cannot go peacefully, we cannot go against them. But what is threatening other citizens of other states is what we don't like. What is giving them ultimatum is what we don't like. But whatever demand, which is supposed to be peacefully, it should have been the UN agencies and other local organizations to look into this, whether their demands is right or not.
Ajak is praising the Jonglei state government for apprehending the youth leaders trying to cause panic and fear in Boer. He says South Sudan's constitution allows all South Sudanese citizens to live and work anywhere in the country. Another group calling itself the United States of Equatoria have posted letter on the social media asking cattle keepers from Jonglei to remove their cattle from areas in Equatoria. South Sudan in Focus could not confirm the source of the letter or individuals who wrote it. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The Yei River State government is threatening not to pay salaries to state officials who have relocated to Juba. The finance minister for Yei River State, Kenyi Abazia John, says 80% of the state employees have not reported to Yei since President Salva Kiir created the state in 2015. VOA News Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Minister of Finance and Public Service John says the employees who continue to stay in Juba are at risk of not getting their salaries. Since last year, a majority of the Yei River State employees staying in Juba have been collecting their monthly salaries from the State Coordination Office in Juba. Some of the Yei River State employees currently living in Juba say they are unable to return to Yei because they do not feel safe due to the rampant insecurity in the area. But John says Yei River State will pay much salaries for employees who are in Juba.
Salary, which is the last one to get in Juba, is the match one. After that, we'll have the salary here. You will have to get it here as I get mine here, as whoever is here is getting his salary here. So we will not be paying salary to people who are in Juba. Nobody will eat their money. It will remain in the bank and until they are here, and then they will receive it.
John says several senior public servants, including directors in the state ministries and employees in grade 1 to 5, have not relocated to Yei. Majority of the Yei River State employees currently in Juba say they were trapped in the capital after the Juba-Yei road became impassable following the outbreak of fighting in Juba between government forces and rebels loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar in July last year. Lomonoja Peter works for the Yei River State Information, Youth and Culture Ministry. He says he will only go to his workstation in Yei when peace is restored in the area.
If the peace resumes in the state, the all employees of Yei, their willingness to go and to work in Yei. Yei is good for the, you'll be able to cultivate, you'll eat your own food, and you'll be able to get the plot and you'll build.
Peter wants the government to restore peace so that all state employees can return home. Asked whether he is concerned about the state government's threat to suspend payment of salaries of employees who are yet to report to their workstations, Peter says he doesn't care. After all, the government has not paid employees' salaries for months.
We're working in the state as we are now serving our community, as our people. Now we are, you get our people, even our colleague, 3 months, 3 to 4 months without salary, and we are now survive. If they say, if we not go to Yei, we'll not receive our salary, we say it's no problem.
John says the state government has hired a guest house to accommodate all its senior employees who have no accommodation in Yei. He says the employees have no excuse for now.
The law stipulates that whoever is employed by government or any institution have to be working in his station, in work station. So that's what we are discussing about. And I'm thankful the Director General of Public Services here is already making way for, paving way for those who are preparing to come, so that by the time they come, they get everything ready.
Some of the Yei River State employees, including lawmakers, are among the hundreds of thousands of people who fled to Uganda and have resettled in refugee settlement camps. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Many countries are concerned about where the Trump administration is headed on its Africa policy. Several positions on Africa remain vacant. As Carol Van Damme reports from Washington, foreign policy experts say the proposed White House budget for fiscal year 2018 would shift a significant amount of funding from humanitarian and development projects to military support.
The proposed Pentagon budget from the White House calls for spending an extra $52 billion in addition to a $575 billion budget. Traditional U.S. spending on humanitarian and development assistance across Africa has not been featured in the budget. Stephen Morrison is Senior Vice President at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
There's a pretty stark cutback in humanitarian relief. I think it's 44%. And then on long-term development funding and other things, there's very significant reductions.
That would be a major shift in U.S. foreign policy going back through Republican and Democratic administrations. Morrison says such changes would particularly impact South Sudan.
The United States obviously has played a massive role, stretching back now 30 years, in being the lead provider of humanitarian assistance into South Sudan. Under all sorts of different scenarios of the last 30 years. And it has obviously played a lead role in the facilitation of the negotiations that led to independence.
The analyst says the U.S. played a key role, along with IGAD and the African Union, in hammering out the South Sudan 2015 peace agreement to bring an end to the more than three-year-long conflict. Many foreign policy experts and military leaders believe a major shift in U.S. foreign policy would hurt American interests in the long run. General Griffin Feary, commander of the Malawi Defense Forces, was quoted by the New York Times recently as saying, "We have statements out of Washington about significant reductions in foreign aid. Experience has shown us that diplomacy and security must come together." General Fury was speaking at the African Land Forces Summit, where more than 120 American Army officers met with military leaders from 40 African countries. Morrison says it's become hard to see where U.S. foreign policy on Africa is leading, since Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has not said much about Africa.
So far, I don't think we've seen much. I mean, keep in mind that you had, in the Obama administration, you had Susan Rice as National Security Advisor, former Assistant Secretary for African Affairs in the Clinton administration. Gail Smith is the head of USAID, and before that, in a senior role as an assistant to the president for matters that encompassed these humanitarian emergencies. And both Susan and Gail had played major roles in driving U.S. policy on South Sudan.
But U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass, a Democrat from California, says she and her colleagues on the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee had a good meeting with Secretary Tillerson just a few weeks ago.
We were happy to hear that he does understand the significance of diplomacy and humanitarian efforts and was very committed to many regions in the world. I specifically asked him about Africa and found him to be very knowledgeable and certainly aware and sensitive to our needs.
Bass says she's not drawing any conclusions about the Trump administration's position on its humanitarian and development funding on Africa from the proposed White House budget.
So I will remain optimistic that Secretary Tillerson will continue to move things forward. I think with the administration, it's going to be important for us to make sure that there is an awareness and understanding of the significance of the continent. And I do think that there's going to be a bit of a difference from the White House to the State Department, even though, of course, the secretary is a part of the administration.
Bass says since it was a breakfast meeting with the entire committee, she did not get a chance to ask Tillerson detailed questions about South Sudan funding. But she did make the case for emergency funding to alleviate the famine in South Sudan, which she said Tillerson was aware of and expressed his concern for the South Sudanese people. Since the meeting with Tillerson, famine has been eased in the two counties of former Unity State, where it was declared by the South Sudan government and the United Nations. But aid agency officials have warned that food insecurity is still rampant in many parts of South Sudan. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, can music bring enemies and friends on the same table? Stay tuned for an answer to that question when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
in your opinion, what are the best ways to fight corruption?
To fight corruption, our people need to be enlightened, and there should be a system in place. We need to strengthen our institutions, because if institutions are strong enough, then I'm sure corruption will be minimized.
By setting up tribunal, because that worked, it worked really very, very smooth for Burkinabes, and in that way, Burkina Faso almost realized their dream, which was fighting corruption.
The best is to have strong institutions which are independent, like the Anti-Corruption Commission must be independent of all that proceedings, giving them powers to investigate, to prosecute, and all that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Leaders of a group calling itself I Am Peace say they are using arts to unite different South Sudanese communities in various refugee settlements in Uganda. Peter Simon Apiku has more for VOA from Adjumani in northern Uganda.
I Am Peace is an initiative launched by South Sudanese and Ugandans to promote peaceful coexistence among South Sudanese refugees in Uganda and host communities. The youth-led initiative was officially launched in May and is sponsored by Adjumani-based Radio Amani. The project's leaders, who refer to themselves as peace ambassadors, include refugees and youth from the host communities. Sambro Lupai is a South Sudanese refugee and radio presenter at Radio Amani. Lupai says he started the project when he noticed a sudden rise in tensions and even violence in and around the camps, especially after the arrival of a large number of refugees following renewed violence in South Sudan in July 2016.
We've realized that actually when you move around the camps and also when you move around Adjumani town in particular, you see some elements of disunity among the refugees and also between the refugees and the host communities. So we came up with this idea to engage the youth into peace-building activities and also find a platform for them to peacefully coexist.
One of the first activities of I Am Peace Project was a talent search competition in April, which brought together refugees and Ugandan artists to showcase talents in music, dance, and drama. Lupai says the five-week-long event ended with several winners. Deng Thon Balok, a young rapper who fled from South Sudan, won a prize for being the best rapper. Balok, who is also known by his stage name Black Diamond, says throughout the competition he saw people accept him for what he was rather than reject him on the basis of his tribe.
People become happy whenever I perform. I get a lot of people, let me say all people become happy for me and they support me. It is everybody, it's not only from South Sudan, but whenever people I meet there, all get impressed of what I do.
Wani Tony is another member of I Am Peace Project. Tony says the values of I Am Peace Project has helped to change his perception of people such as Balok.
He's a dinka, I'm a cook, who easily associate by the, who exchange ideas, we sit down together. Now, besides that, for example, the host communities, the Madis, right now, the Madi people, we sit down together. Sometimes we associate freely with them. So that is, to some extent, like bridging up the gap between the refugees and the host communities.
Brenda Mungunini is a Ugandan who works with the local government in Adjumani district and is one of the ambassadors of I Am Peace Project. She says the project's initiatives for peaceful coexistence convinced her to sign up. Mungunini says sometimes negative attitudes towards refugees by the host community are caused by a lack of understanding of the challenges refugees face each day.
People don't really feel what refugees feel. Me, I'm a Ugandan, and really people look at refugees in a different way, but when you get to know what they feel, you approach them in a different way. You think about being peaceful with them, seeing them as brothers and sisters.
Manzi Jolly Joe is a Ugandan artist, songwriter, and producer. Joe says he understands exactly how refugees feel.
When it's time for entertainment, you find there will be nothing like this is a South Sudanese, this is a Dinka, this is a Kuku, or like this is a Ugandan, this is a South Sudanese. It will always bring them together. That's why I always tell people, like, I believe in music for peace.
Lupai says the support Balok received throughout the talent search event is what I Am Peace team has been campaigning for in the refugee settlements in Uganda.
It was a very big success because he was not only cheered by refugees, he was cheered by everybody. He was cheered by citizens, he was cheered by refugees, he was cheered by people who did not belong to his ethnicity.
For Balok, who had dropped out of school due to lack of fees, winning the talent search competition and the support of participants from different ethnic groups and nationalities was not only the best thing that came out of the event. He received a cash prize of 500,000 Ugandan shillings and I Am Peace Project offered him a full scholarship to resume his senior secondary education. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Adjumani, Northern Uganda.
From Adjumani, we move to Cameroon, where suicide attacks continue to climb in northern part of the country, with deadly attacks on three different localities reported since Saturday. Muki Edwin Kinzeka has the story for VOA from Mora.
The past week has seen suicide bombings in the communities of Fomenka, Mora and Kerawa, near Cameroon's border with Nigeria. Cameroonian military officials and the governor of the far north region tell VOA the attacks killed at least 20 people, including 9 suicide bombers. The head of the self-defense group in the village of Kerawa, Mubawu Isaac, told VOA at least 100 residents have fled since the attack there on Saturday.
On a dit, oh, stoppez-vous. Les femmes ont commencé à trembler, elles ont commencé à avoir peur.
He says when members of his self-defense group started shooting at the three suspects with stones, bow and arrows, one who was disguised as a pregnant woman struggled to detonate her explosives. He says they succeeded in overpowering her. The failed bomber, a 17-year-old, was handed to the military. However, he said the other two female bombers were able to blow themselves up, killing four people. Suicide attacks have resurged in northern Cameroon since late May. The resurgence coincided with the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which has now ended. However, military officials also see the incidents as linked to military operations across the border in northeast Nigeria. Nigerian General Lucky Leon Irabo took command of the 7,000-strong multinational joint task force in May. Since then, he says, they have organized the ongoing raids on remaining Boko Haram strongholds as part of plans to eradicate terrorism within the shortest possible time.
My priority is to build on the successes, ensuring that the partnership that has existed is increased to a higher level. And of course, as the threat is dynamic, for us to find newer ways of addressing those dynamic challenges.
The commander of Cameroonian troops fighting in the regional force, General Buba Dobe Creo, says suicide bombers have been able to escape the raids and make it into Cameroon, disguised as refugees or internally displaced persons. He says they have to do everything possible with Nigerian authorities to stop the massive influx of refugees into Cameroon. He says they have recovered equipment from the militants and destroyed Boko Haram ammunition and vehicles, but warns the suicide bombing attacks will continue. He says officials are concerned more female suicide bombers remain at large. The government says it has deployed more troops to the border area and given more communications material to local self-defense groups so they can report suspicious activity. The Boko Haram conflict has displaced about 200,000 people in northern Cameroon and sent another 75,000 Nigerian refugees across the border into Cameroon. Nearly three-quarters of the displaced are women and children. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Mora, Cameroon.
A new report says civilians in Central African Republic are being killed by armed groups with wholesale impunity. Human Rights Watch issued a 92-page report today called Killing Without Consequence. Luis Mugi is the Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, he spoke to VOA's Jordi Kapwa about the report.
This latest report is not only stuff that's going on now in 2017, but we actually took a more historic view. We really wanted to try to document in detail what we consider to be war crimes and potentially crimes against humanity committed by both anti-Balaka and Seleka fighters. And we wanted to name names of commanders. So this is a much longer, deeper segment of research that we usually have done on the Central African Republic. And we're doing it in the spirit of trying to really call for the urgent placement of the Special Criminal Court. This is an international hybrid court that will be made up of both international and national prosecutors and judges. And this court, we feel, is the best chance to try to address these cycles of impunity that continue to drive this violence. So we wanted to really lay out years of Human Rights Watch's research. This is over 500 people that we've documented who have been killed. That is just the tip of the iceberg. But we think it demonstrates the widespread nature of the killing.
How many people did you name in the report for allegedly committing war crimes?
Well, Well, we name some pretty high-level Seleka commanders. We tie some anti-Balaka commanders to some high-level anti-Balaka commanders in Bongi. The Seleka commanders that we name, there's three or four of them. These are individuals who are probably not going to be sought after by the International Criminal Court. These are not the heads of the Seleka, but we feel these are individuals who control troops on the ground, and these are troops on the ground that we've demonstrated over and over again from 2014 to 2017 that these troops have committed what we consider to be war crimes. We do think it's important to really name these names and hopefully provide a first line of investigations for this special criminal court to follow.
Tell us about some of the crimes named in the report.
This is a report that only focused on specific war crimes. We wanted to focus on the killing of civilians, particularly women and children. We wanted to focus on pillage and destruction of towns and homes and villages. And we wanted to focus on the targeting of civilians who had fled into the bush by these armed groups. We also focused on the life in displacement camps. As you may know, basically the center and eastern Central African Republic consists of towns in which the majority of people, tens and tens of thousands of people, are in displacement camps. There's over 500,000 people in displacement camps right now in the country of 4.6 million. And it's very difficult for them to leave the camps and get firewood and get food because they're killed. We did not focus on sexual violence because that is a completely other body of work that Human Rights Watch is currently working on. And we look to put out a very large report along the same lines in terms of length and depth of this report we released today on sexual violence used as a weapon of war by both the anti-Balaka and the Seleka. We strongly feel that the impunity that has accompanied this violence is a key driver for this continuing fighting that we're seeing.
Now, you talked about bringing them to justice, and you talked about the courts. When might this happen if the courts decide to prosecute?
As we know, the International Criminal Court takes a long time. It's a bureaucratic international structure and takes a long time to get any even trial up and running. The Special Criminal Court names their international prosecutor, so that's the face of the court. He was named in February. The National Deputy Prosecutor was named in May. And just yesterday, key national judges were sworn in. So we are looking at a court that should be up and running by the end of the year and should be starting investigations. And there's a real chance, and I'm not being optimistic here, I think I'm being a realist, or maybe I can say cautiously optimistic, but I think there's a real chance we will see this court functioning in the sense of starting to bring people to trial by mid to late 2018.
That's Luis Mugge of Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song No More War by Ras Corby.
Well, just checking off the global scene all over the world right now, seeing Rasta citizens. We need a global love, you know, and a global solution. And must be a conclusion. Sure! Rastafari, to stop the war. No more war in Africa. The people gotta live up to Jah. No more war in the Middle East. The people are fighting the peace. No more war in America. The people gotta live up to Jah. No more war in Asia. We gotta keep it nice and neat, y'all. Our people suffering around the world today. They're trying to find a solution. We look around and nowhere to hide. Not even a single place to run. How can you say you're leading the world without love? So how can you say you're leading the world without peace? Circumstances meet people along the way. They need someone to turn to. Only Jah has the solution. No mankind has it on his own. We were created in the image and the likeness of Jah. Mankind, don't try to fool yourself. Wake up in the morning, you see the sun.
We have been listening to Ras Corby with the song No More War. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. No more war in the Middle East.
people are fighting the peace. No more war in America. The people gotta live up to Jah. No more war in Asia. We gotta keep.